Hi, this is Chuck Wolf, and we're interviewing Julian D. Ford, Ph.D. He received his Ph.D. in clinical psychology from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He is professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and director of the University of Connecticut Health Center, Child Trauma Clinic, and Center for Trauma Response Recovery and Preparedness. He's developed the target treatment model for adult, adolescent, and child traumatic stress disorders. Dr. Ford is the principal investigator on several federally funded studies evaluating target and other evidence-based psychosocial empowerment interventions for families, adults, and youth. He's provided expert consultation on traumatic stress research and treatment to the World Health Organization, United States Department of Veterans Affairs, United States Public Health Service Substance Abuse, and Mental Health Services Administration. In talking with Dr. Ford this today, I'm interested in comparing what he does to what we do on our show. Our show, of course, is called The Emotion Roadmap, Take the Wheel and Control How You Feel. And Dr. Ford, in the work that we've talked about that you're doing, you seem to have found and discovered a process that helps people deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome as well as addiction. And I'm fascinated because it does look like it reflects the ability to help people to change the way they feel through a very intricate process that you have tested and researched and seem to have quite a bit of success with. In my last show in December, I was talking a bit about veterans returning from the combat duty that they're serving over in Afghanistan and Iraq. And post-traumatic stress syndrome has been with us forever, but it seems to be happening quite a bit. Perhaps we're just more knowledgeable about what this is. But you seem to have one of the few programs that seems to treat it successfully. And what a couple of things I'd like, if you could, is to start by telling us a little bit about how you got involved with this, and then perhaps specifically to talk a little bit about veterans, returning veterans, and the grant that you have that's looking at helping veterans deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Great, Chuck. That's a lot to cover, but I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
So let me start at the beginning. I've been a therapist now for over 30 years, and I noticed early on that many of my clients, and I've worked with people of all ages and all backgrounds, that a common dilemma was that these were often very, very intelligent people, and even if they didn't test all that great on intelligence tests, they had many other kinds of intelligence, and I know you've addressed that in many ways on your show. And what seemed to be a common dilemma was that there were times where their ability to think clearly just seemed to be completely lost. And those were typically moments of high stress, but they often were moments where nothing necessarily terrible or traumatic was happening. It might have even actually been a very good time. In fact, it can happen just as much when a person is very relaxed and sleeping and has a very, very intense nightmare, which is certainly characteristic of many different stress-related problems, including post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as well as times where really terrible things are happening. And what I learned from that, and I really learned this not from textbooks but from the people who I listened to, was that something happened for them emotionally that they didn't understand and that seemed to pretty much short-circuit their thinking process, even though they were highly intelligent people. And it's almost as if they lost 30 points of IQ when they really hadn't. They were still just as smart as they ever had been, but at that moment, thinking clearly just seemed almost impossible or wasn't even imaginable. And what that led me to then look into was, what do we know scientifically about how emotional distress can override the ability to think clearly? And as I looked into studies on that, most of which I've not done, but which colleagues have done all over the world, it became pretty clear to me that whether we're looking at pictures of brain images through neuroimaging, or whether we're looking at tests of how people react to stress and with body chemicals and hormones, or whether we're asking people about how they feel using questionnaires or interviews, a common denominator was that when a situation occurred that the individual experienced as a serious threat, even if they weren't necessarily consciously aware of that, there seemed to be a kind of an automatic change. And there's a lot of research that certainly supports this idea that there are areas in the brain, and the one area in particular is called the emotional brain. It's sometimes called technically the limbic system, and there's an area in that that's called the amygdala, which I imagine you've talked about with people on your show. And it seemed to me that, in essence, what we were talking about here was an alarm center in the brain that most of us know we have but don't really know what to do about. And so that's really how I developed Target as an approach to helping people to walk through step-by-step a kind of a protocol, which is very individual. It's different for each person, but it can be described in general terms, a way to actually turn down and over time readjust this alarm center in the brain. Now, I don't have any proof as yet that any therapy, including Target, actually does reset this alarm center in the brain. There are some studies that suggest that successful treatment for anxiety disorders and for depression may actually reduce the degree or intensity of activation of this alarm center in the brain. And those studies also suggest that what happens is that people learn how to activate an area in their brain that is more like, in what we call in Target, a thinking center. And that's just the front and the very outer part of the brain. Technically, it's called the prefrontal cortex, or the outer area of the brain, the cortex. So what we do in Target then, and what I've learned to do from my clients over many years, is to simply walk through a process of not turning off or getting rid of that alarm, but literally resetting it by using it in a different way than we typically are used to.
Let me stop and just ask you a couple of things. One of them is that there's a fellow named Dan Goleman who has written a book that's very popular called Emotional Intelligence and Why It Might Matter More than IQ. And in his interviews about that book, he talks a little bit about something called the amygdala hijack, and that a lot of people have had the experience. It's almost like an out-of-body experience, they feel, where I can't believe this is me. They're kind of seeing themselves completely overreacting to an emotional situation without any kind of rational thought. And even while it's happening, they're somewhat aware that it's happening, but not in control of it.
Exactly.
And it seems like when you were talking about it, it goes back to, I remember doing some research years ago on Hans Selye's stress response to, you know, primeval situations where you're a man with a club and you've got something that looks big and fierce and you have to decide whether you're going to eat it or it's going to eat you. And so you have to either run or fight. And
that's right.
It seems like what happens with stress traumatic disorders is that those feelings come inappropriately. Sometimes it's real, but that they just pop up all of a sudden out of nowhere.
Exactly, and that's why it can be a disorder, because it doesn't seem to be appropriate, even though for the individual at that moment, the feeling is something terrible is happening or is about to happen, and I have to react, but I don't know why, and that's why it can be so puzzling and disconcerting, because the individual himself or herself often is more puzzled than anybody else. Why is my body acting like there's a crisis or a catastrophe happening when I know it's not, but I can't argue with my body? Well, what we suggest, and yes, I'm very much building on the excellent work that's been done in the field on emotional intelligence, and I'm very grateful for the researchers who have done that work. What we're really saying is that there is a way to actually help the thinking area, the conscious area of the brain. And again, I'm a bit oversimplifying because the brain really works, all parts of the brain work together at any given time. But for the sake of discussion, it's useful to think of this one area of the brain that does that is the center of our conscious thinking. For that area of the brain to actually be able to communicate to this alarm center, and that's not as if there are two separate people inside of us. I am not saying that at all, but it's more like a conversation between two parts of our own minds. And the conversation usually goes something like this, which is the alarm center, the amygdala, says, something terrible is happening and you're not doing anything about it, and therefore I'm taking over and I'm going to make your heart pound and make your blood boil or make you run away or make you fight back or yell and scream or any number of reactions that you wouldn't ordinarily ever think of doing. But right now, because things are so dangerous and you're not handling it, I'm going to take over. And, of course, that's not exactly what happens, but in some respects, that's what it can feel like. The amygdala hijack metaphor is a great way of putting it. It's as if that part of the brain takes over and runs the show. So what we're essentially doing is helping the thinking area of the brain have a conversation and regain control. But in some ways, what you have to think about is that the alarm is there to protect us, and so it's a necessary part of the brain and a necessary part of our brains helping us to survive and to do well. So we can't get rid of it, and we also can't just shut it off, because that actually yields even a greater alarm reaction. The harder you try to not think about something that's dangerous or pretend it doesn't bother you, the more that it tends to be either a real danger or to be disturbing. So the kind of conversation is more like an adult talking to a 2 or 3 year old child, where the 2 or 3 year old child is raising a legitimate concern. Something needs to be paid attention to, and something needs to be handled. But the 2 or 3 year old child doesn't really know how to handle it and is going to take extreme measures. The adult, on the other hand, can't just tell the 2 or 3 year old child to shut up and go away, or to not be so upset, because that doesn't really work. What the adult has to do then is be very calm and very thoughtful and very confident. And that's extraordinarily difficult to do when you're having an alarm reaction, but that's exactly what people realize through Target and other therapies that they are capable of doing. And the only twist that we put on that that's a little different than some other therapies is that we in Target, we start from the presumption that everybody is able to do this. They just don't know that how to do it, and they don't know the abilities that they have. So what we do in Target is we help people to recognize that they are actually able to be very calm when they're having a stress reaction if they draw on some inner strengths that they haven't typically thought about drawing on at those moments of high stress.
One of the things that strikes me that's interesting in what you're saying is that I work at the University of Hartford. I teach a course on emotional intelligence in organizations. And I'm familiar with some research, not necessarily from my own work, but also my wife teaches there. And she's deals with freshmen, while I deal with graduate students. And some of the research about freshmen is that prefrontal cortex areas aren't fully developed, and that helps to explain some of the very emotionally challenging behavior that you see when people first come on campus.
That's right. That's the normal state of the adolescent and the young adult, still learning how to use all of their thinking capacities. Very smart, but not quite ready to use their full capacities yet, and that's why college and classes like yours and your wife's are so important.
Well, it also strikes me that you're also dealing with adults, not just adolescents. And,
that's right.
And in dealing with adults, they probably have physiologically at least developed fully a prefrontal cortex that helps to, you know, give this executive function and control over your emotional experience. But it seems like when people have experienced these traumatic events, that they lose control over that. So it would seem like almost for everybody it would be helpful to learn how to strengthen this, and that's what your program seems to want to do.
Exactly, Chuck. And this is something that developed in my work with people who've experienced traumatic events, life-threatening or just very, very horrible experiences in childhood or in adulthood, including abuse, but also, as you're talking about, at war as a military personnel. But this really is applicable to every single one of us because we all have alarm reactions and we all need to know what to do in order to basically help the alarm system in our brain not take over and hijack things. And so we begin with the idea then that this is essentially a universal toolkit, and frankly, there's no user's guide to how to help the brain recover from and shift out of alarm mode that I know of. The closest thing that I know is what we're trying to do in Target and in some other similar therapies. So in some sense, it's more like a user's manual than it is a complicated treatment technique. And we try to make it something that is very understandable to people from all backgrounds. You don't have to have an advanced education to understand this very, very clearly. Everybody knows what it's like to have an alarm reaction, and almost nobody has ever gotten any guidance as to what can you do to actually shift that alarm so that it plays its normal function and its ideal function, which is simply to be a kind of a wake-up call, pay attention signal rather than a catastrophe, just jump, run, fight, flight. That's the alarm in extreme conditions, but most of the time all it does is just help us pay attention when we need to. So what we do in Target is we just basically replay the steps that the mind goes through and the thinking areas in the brain go through when we are actually able to communicate clearly that we've got a situation handled. I've tried to make it really clear. One of the first clients in a group that did this asked to have this all summarized, the whole therapy summarized in one word where each letter spells something that is part of the process. And so what we came up with was the word that seemed to be most applicable for any of us when we're feeling under stress. We want to have freedom from that stress reaction. And so the word freedom then becomes a useful acronym where F stands for focus. And I can tell you more about how we do it. We have a nice, easy, quick way to help the brain get focused. And then the rest of the steps basically have to do with recognizing what's triggering you. That's the R. Identifying your emotions, but identifying not only the emotions that your alarm is telling you to pay attention to, like anger, fear, worry, sadness, but also the emotions that you are experiencing that are a source of strength that actually are right there even when you're having a stress reaction. They just get lost in all the noise. So we help people to learn how to refocus so that they not only pay attention to emotions that are triggered by the alarm, but also emotions that give them a sense of confidence, strength, and security. And then we go on, the second E is to evaluate your thoughts, and we do the same thing. Identify the thoughts that the alarm puts forward, like, I got to get out of here, I can't stand this is terrible, I can't handle this. But also to identify thoughts that are right there at the same time but are getting lost in the shuffle, like, actually, I can handle this. I do know what to do. I'm just feeling so stressed that it's hard to keep my focus. And once you start to zero in on those kinds of grounding or reorienting feelings and thoughts, it then becomes possible to define, that's the D step, what are your goals, not just the goals that have to do with stress and with fight and flight, but also the goals that reflect what's really important to you in your life. And as people begin to do that, they realize that there's a kind of a calming feeling, like I'm getting back to the foundation. And even though I'm still under stress, I can feel some strength that comes from my inner ability to handle things, to know what's important. And then they start to choose, and that's the O in freedom, the options. They start to be able to choose the thoughtful, mindful choices that reflect their emotional intelligence and recognize how different those are from the alarm choices or options, which are perfectly good if there is a crisis, but not very good if there's not a crisis. And the final step, the M, is by doing this, what I found is this is the single best way that any of us as human beings can make a contribution to our world, to our society, and to our loved ones, because the emotionally regulated person is the person who really makes a difference. So that, in a nutshell, I've now given you about a semester's worth of information about the intervention. Let's talk about what you think would be interesting.
What I'd like to say is that it mirrors, in some ways, what I've done in the general sense of trying to take what I've learned about the emotional abilities that exist in each of us that are unique, and I'll ask you about that in a second, because I think it makes a difference in terms of your abilities, how well you respond to a methodology like yours. But the approach that I've taken is this idea of an emotion roadmap, which simply says, identify how you're feeling and identify how anyone who might be key to what you're doing is feeling. And you're only normally doing this when you're stuck or emotionally stuck and you're being reflective, because when things are going fine, you're not stopping and thinking about how you're feeling. But when you are stuck and emotionally challenged, by looking at how you are feeling, identifying what is, and then asking yourself, what would be more ideal? What would be more ideal to feel, which is not different than your approach as you look at...
No, very, very similar.
Yeah, that's what I like. That's why I liked it so much as I was talking to you about how it fit for our show. And then once you've established what is and what's ideal, the idea of a roadmap is, how do I get from feeling, for instance, betrayed to feeling trusting again if I love someone enough to give them a chance after I feel like they betrayed me, which is about the longest emotional journey that I know that anybody can take.
Yes.
And then from your choices, through understanding how your choices are about understanding how emotions work, that's part of it, but also understanding you. And that goes back to what you just said, which is, you know, somehow mirrored in what you're reflecting, all these thoughts about why I can't do something is somewhere in there a way that has worked for you that says I can do this. And in you're looking at how you think, how you feel, how you act, and looking at all of that, you want to try and find something that you might have experienced in your lifetime that represents a thematic approach to how do I move myself back from betrayal to trust. If I've ever been successful at that, what worked for me in the past, and can I build on that? And then the management piece for me is, when you look at your scenarios and you're choosing that option piece,
mm-hmm.
the questions I ask are, okay, so what is it that I'm really willing to do? Because some of the options that come up that might work, honestly, I'm not really willing to do them.
Yep.
And then secondly, even if I'm willing, the other question that's critical is, am I able? So willing and able are different questions. One's attitudinal, one's ability-based. But if you don't say yes to both of those, the scenario you've picked for yourself is unlikely to work.
That's right.
So I think it mirrors this. Now, the question I have that would be interesting to follow up on the freedom approach that you talk about is, what if people differ in their abilities? For instance, when I've worked with Peter Salovey, he's the provost at Yale University, and he and his colleague Jack Mayer, they discovered this idea of an emotional intelligence, a real intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different definitions out there, but theirs is really based on the idea that we don't all have the same abilities, and the fact that we don't have the same abilities makes a big difference in life, and knowing what our abilities are helps us to know where we can develop some abilities we might not have that are developmental, where we might have some weaknesses, things that we really can't change, what we could do to compensate, and where we have some strengths, how do we leverage them? So for instance, for me, and the idea of being able to manage your emotions is, if somebody scores really low on that, it would seem to me they would have a harder time following through on your freedom approach than somebody who already has the heightened ability that's recognized through assessment, but also through life, to manage their emotions successfully.
I quite agree, and I think that Dr. Salovey and Meyer's research is a very important base for the work that you're doing and the work that I'm doing. And what I particularly like about their work and how you're describing it is that they're not talking, as I understand it, they're not talking about necessarily more or less in a good-bad sense, but more in a sense of different kinds of abilities that each one of us has to a different degree. So the implication for me is that I think that actually everyone has tremendous, there's no person I've met, regardless of how they test on any measure, intelligence, emotional intelligence, every individual who I've come across, and this includes young children as well, has the ability or has great strength in managing emotions, but typically they do not know what those strengths are. And so our job often is to help the individual to identify how they actually do, just as you said, how they do manage emotions effectively, rather than, unfortunately, in many therapies in the past have focused more on what people can't do or what people are limited or quote-unquote deficient in doing. I think the approach you're taking and that I'm taking is very different in that we build on strengths, and there is no individual who is not able to manage their emotions. It's just that most of us have never had any guidance in any systematic way to be able to tap into the strengths that we have and use them very selectively. So a very simple example, some people use the freedom steps by focusing a lot on how their bodies are feeling. And when they pay attention to how their bodies are feeling, tense, relaxed, strong, weak, activated, exhausted, as they do that, they are able to actually gain a sense of control that then accomplishes exactly what we're working on with the freedom steps. But for another person, they may not really be all that able or all that interested in focusing on their body. They may gain this sense of control from being able to analyze something in more of a cognitive and an intellectual way. And sometimes that gets a bad reputation, like, oh, that's just being intellectualized and you're not really dealing with your emotions. Well, actually, for many people, thinking through something so that you have a clear sense of what it means to you, why it's important, and what you can do about it that makes a difference in a way that is important to you, that is a very emotionally powerful and effective way of managing stress. Well, so it's very much a matter of how does each individual manage their emotions rather than who really has the greater degree of ability.
One of the things I really like about your approach, and where it complements what I'm doing myself, is that you've got the idea of a user's manual is terrific, that you actually take people through and teach them how to do these steps with some concrete application and some research-based methodologies that
exactly
seem to like fall all the way through, so that you go from, you know, focused all the way through to somehow making a meaningful difference and all those steps in between. One of the things that strikes me in terms of the difference, the work that I do is often geared to conceptually talking to people about how the emotion roadmap works and then looking at their life and helping them to think through, you know, on anything where they're stuck. Sometimes it feels like magic where I just, you know, someone wanted to tell me about how they were having a difficult time with some in-laws, and someone had written a 55-page letter outlining their 30-year history together and the problems that had taken place over 30 years. And I said, you know what, I don't really need to know what's in that letter. What I need to know is, what are you feeling about them and what are they feeling about you to the best of your knowledge? Uh-huh. And what would be more ideal? And then let's back into the parts of the letter that might relate to that. And that's a way of looking, just, you know, strip away the content, look at the emotional piece, focus on how to make the emotions better, more ideal for what you're trying to accomplish. And that's the way I conceptually approach helping people learn how to do this.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, Chuck. And what I like about that is that you're teaching by modeling how to take an enormous amount of information that would be overwhelming for anybody and to find a focus, a way of approaching that vast amount of information that is very manageable for anyone. And one pathway that's really powerful that you've particularly developed is the emotion pathway, where what it means to you and what you're feeling is really a way to take 50 pages, 50 years of a life, and bring it all into focus in a way that then the person can understand why they're feeling what they're feeling, why they're doing what they're doing. We do it with emotion, but The idea with the freedom steps is, for some individuals, the way to focus is not their emotions initially, even though that is always important at some point. It may be more, this may be a more goal-driven person, somebody who's really into setting goals, accomplishing things, doing worthwhile works, and having a purpose. In that case, that individual may find that a really useful way to focus is by clarifying which of their goals in their life really have to do with stress and stress reactions, and which goals are really reflective of their fundamental values and hopes and abilities. So we're basically using a very similar process. We just want to make sure that we start with each individual where their focal point is most naturally, and then build from that to the variety of different ways of focusing that are, that you're teaching and that we teach in the Freedom Steps.
Julian, we have the experience where, for me, it's kind of like a diamond cutter. If you understand what a diamond cutter does, they have to find the right spot to strike in order to create the perfect formation for what they're looking to get when their results are over. What I find when I work with individuals, if I don't find that key place to strike, the right thing to say that ties into what they really value and care about, then I haven't got them. Once I catch what's most important to them, and I frame what we're doing in a way that helps them to see how they could be better at that, then I think that we're on a track where we're very much in sync, and then we talk about the emotional aspects of it.
That's great. I couldn't agree with you more. That's a wonderful way to describe the process, and that's exactly the process. And you know, that's just, if I may throw this in, the way that we help people to begin to recognize their abilities to focus their mind, the thinking center in their brain, so to speak, is we just suggest a very simple 3-step way of focusing, which is easy to remember because it comes from the universal call for help, the SOS. So we just say, and this is so similar to what you just described, say, if you want to focus your mind, and it's not something that you can do just by saying, okay, I think I'll be focused. You have to actually do something with your thinking right at this moment, but it's not that complicated. You just slow down and sweep your mind clear. So that's the first S. And then when your mind is as clear as possible, then the O in SOS is orient yourself. And what I've learned is the way that people orient themselves is actually by focusing on one thought that they choose. Only one. And that's extraordinarily difficult, except for people who are really, really well trained and skilled at meditation, for whom this is something that they have worked at for years and years. But for the rest of us, to orient to one thought that you choose because it is the most important thing to you right at this moment. No judgments, but clearly focusing on what your values, your goals, your hopes, what is important to you, rather than focusing on what we typically focus on, which is what's the problem, what should I be doing, what do I have to do. All of those thoughts are really alarm thoughts. So we say orient to your main thought, which is one thing that's important to you right this moment. And by the way, I've had people come up with some very creative ones, like just thinking about being on a desert island with a palm tree and the breeze blowing. It can be as wonderfully visual as that, or it can be a thought that is very specific, like what's important to me right now is my relationship with this particular person. And then the final S in SOS is just a self-check, and we suggest that people do a very quick self-rating of 2 things. One is, how much stress are you feeling right at this moment? And I borrowed this from many, many other researchers, who it's called subjective units of distress. You just say, 1 is no stress at all, best I've ever felt, and 10 is the most stress I've ever felt in my life. And usually for most of us, we're somewhere in between the 1 and the 10. And then the second rating is the one that often gets overlooked, and that is, how much personal control do you have right at this moment? Where one is, I can't really think about anything in a focused way, and I'm really feeling completely disorganized and overwhelmed, versus 10 being, I can think very clearly, and I can't control everything in my life, but my thinking is highly focused, and therefore I am in control. So with that simple process, people of all ages seem to find, and by the way, again, I didn't invent this, it's just what people have told me, and I've just tried to kind of make it something that any one of us could use. Just doing that SOS seems to be a way not to manage stress reactions perfectly, but more importantly, to get our minds focused so that when we do have a stress reaction, we're ready to be able to focus at that time.
So it seems like that, I imagine for each of the steps you have, you know, little processes that help people to actually carry them through. And that
we do.
It seems to me, and I, just a couple of things, comments I want to make. One is you might want to consider for the research that you're doing with people with traumatic stress disorders that you use the mesquite to see whether or not people, there's something in the mesquite that might relate, you know, either cause, it might be some causation or correlation mm-hmm. between what people score and how well they do using the freedom approach.
Mm-hmm.
The second thought that I had was it seems like this is something not just for the unhealthy and the people who are struggling, but really it would seem like, I wonder if you've thought at all about where this fits in any kind of curriculum, whether in grade school or college or at any point, as something that's proactive and more, less therapeutic and more just educational.
Well, funny you should mention that, because I couldn't agree with you more again. And I so happens that I actually have the privilege of getting on a video conference later today with a group of educators from two school districts in Washington State who are embarking on exactly that project. And we are going to be working together over the next year on how to blend in some of these aspects of the freedom steps and the target education into their public schools for kids of all ages. I don't want to say that this is the cure for everything or this is the solution to all stress problems, but I do think, and people have told me very, very commonly, it's not something that is just for people who are distressed. This is really something that can be helpful for any of us at any time, because this is what we all have to do. That nobody is exempt from this. It's just that we either do it knowing what we're doing and with a kind of a user's guide to help us to make sure we don't skip over steps or we don't rush to conclusions, or we do it intuitively, and usually that's not as effective as when you're doing it with a user's manual. So, yes, I truly hope that this is something that we can bring to kids in schools, to people who are in business and who can make very amygdala-driven decisions. I remember seeing an article a few years ago about amygdala investing.
Interesting.
And I just don't think there's any limit to the applications. The important thing is that for each individual and for each setting, it's going to be done a little bit differently, and it has to be modified. We had, for example, I wouldn't talk about any specific details, but I remember working with a clinician who was working with a child who had pretty significant intellectual impairments, was really borderline IQ, so fairly low IQ, but a smart little guy, but very, very troubled, and he could not possibly understand the SOS that I just described. So the clinician and I worked on this, and we did a modification where it was red light, stop, yellow light, think, and green light, choose. So instead of SOS, it became red light, yellow light, green light. And he loved that. He taught it to the other kids in his class. The classroom actually put up posters all over the place so that all the kids were doing it, so it wasn't just for him, and it wasn't just because he was having trouble with stress reactions. It was for all the kids. So yes, I really do hope this is something that we can get to a wide variety of audiences, because it's something we all need, even though this isn't necessarily the way that everybody wants to do it.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure you're pretty busy. I don't know if you've thought about doing anything like this in Connecticut. There's a lot of places that would really value it as well. I imagine Washington State approached the people, the school districts approached you somehow and found out about it.
Yes, they did through the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is a network of programs working with kids who have experienced traumatic stress. But absolutely, and there are. Some wonderful programs in Connecticut that are doing this, I should say. In fact, every single detention center for kids, every juvenile detention center, and every single community-based program for kids who are struggling and we want to keep them out of trouble. These are programs run by the Court Support Services Division in our state. Every single one of those programs in the community all over Connecticut are teaching Target to kids in groups.
Well, I don't know if it's possible, Julian, but I'd love to collaborate with you. I think I mentioned to you that one of the people I've worked with in the past is the Mashantucket Pequots.
Yes.
And they have something that they call an intergenerational wound. It's not just it's localized to them, but to all the Native Americans.
Oh, I recognize that as a very, very serious issue, and I'm delighted you're working with them.
And I talked to him a little bit about, you know, the fact that I had met you over the phone and that we were going to be talking, and that at some point, if there's a chance and you wanted to chat about that offline and see about where that might go, if you were interested, I'd love to do that with you.
Absolutely. I can't wait.
Well, great. And the other question I have is, now, people who have an interest in what we've been talking about, and I want to know, so it sounds pretty neat. How do I get connected? I think at one point you were still looking for veterans. I don't know if that's
yes.
still the case. So if you want to talk a little bit about that and how people might contact you if they're interested in kind of exploring, you know, if they're willing to come forward and say, I've got some issues, this sounds like something that might work for me. How do I go forward from here?
Well, thank you, Chuck. I appreciate the opportunity to do that. So I'll start with for anyone who'd be interested in seeing a little more about this, we have a website, and I do have a commercial interest. It's a small company that the University of Connecticut set up to actually enable us to get this out to schools, programs, communities, agencies, all over Connecticut as well as the country and internationally. So the website is advancedtrauma.com. And that's got a bunch of information. It won't answer all the questions, but then there's ways to contact me and my colleagues who are working on getting the word out. And more specifically, the program that you mentioned for military veterans, we are doing a federally funded research study, but it's the kind of research I really like, because every single person who participates in this research can benefit. There is no control group where you don't get nothing. It's a study comparing the Target therapy to another excellent psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder that involves more working on specific traumatic memories, where Target work is more on managing emotions in your current life. But both approaches have tremendous potential benefit. And what we're doing this is we're offering this as a study that military veterans, they have to be men. That's just a condition of the funding. It's not that we don't want to do this with women veterans. We certainly do. And they can be veterans or active duty personnel, Reserve, Guard, National Guard, as long as they have been deployed to either Iraq or Afghanistan at least once. And if they are dealing with issues around anger also, which is incredibly normal and very expectable. But this is our attempt to provide a therapy. We do 10 sessions of either Target or of the other PTSD treatment, and people are randomly assigned, which means it's a flip of a coin. We don't get to decide, and participants don't get to decide which treatment, but either one they get is potentially very, very helpful. So we're looking for any men who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan in the military who would be interested in managing stress or learning about ways to manage stress that might add to what they already know. And the best way to contact us is we have a wonderful research coordinator whose name is Michelle, and her number is 860-679-2587. Or anyone who's interested can feel free to email me. I have a easy-to-remember email also. It's J Ford, all one word, just my first initial and last name, jford@uchc.edu. Or you can just find me on the University of Connecticut Health Center website.
Julian, want to repeat their phone number one time for Michelle?
Absolutely. 860-679-2587. And by the way, we welcome calls from military veterans and personnel themselves, but we've also welcome calls from spouses, significant others, family members who would like to learn more about this and then share that with their spouse or family member.
And we had mentioned this prior to our talk today, and I don't know if you have time left, but
sure.
You had talked a little bit about addiction and how this helps with addiction, and it's another crippling problem in our society. And I wonder if you
yes.
want to talk a little bit about how your program might help people who are finding themselves unable to break an addiction.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, Chuck. So many times addiction is complicated by or even sometimes even largely the result of stress reactions. Not always, but very, very often. And being caught in the throes of substance abuse or substance dependency or any other addiction is enormously stressful. So what we did, actually the very first research study that we did with Target was testing it with men and women who were in treatment for substance abuse issues. And what we found was that they we did this in groups that were either for men or for women, tend to prefer to do it in gender-specific groups just for privacy. We found that actually that they not only improved in terms of by doing this Target program, they were able to improve their ability to manage their emotions, but they felt much more able or to sustain a sense of confidence in sobriety. And that is one of the absolute keys to being able to say no to a very powerful addiction. The confidence that you have in yourself, that you have enough personal control, that when you have that urge to use or start to go down that path of the old habit, that you can focus your mind and gather your strength and choose the pathway that doesn't involve the substance or the other addictive behavior. So in that sense, Target really is not a treatment that is designed to be the only thing to help a person recover from addiction, but it can play a very important role, because if you are able to regain that sense of control and focus your thinking, that makes sobriety or any kind of choice that is not an addictive choice much more possible than when you're driven by alarm or stress reactions. So that, in a nutshell, is how we approach addiction. And fortunately, it appears that that's been very helpful for many people who have been dealing with addiction.
Again, who would they contact if someone's listening and wants to know more about, so they know somebody or themselves, they're addicted, and they'd like to get some help from the work that you do? How would it be the same people they'd contact or somebody different?
Probably, because we're not doing any active programs right now, there are programs in the state that have been doing work with men and women who are in addiction recovery programs. I would actually suggest that the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services for the state of Connecticut has a trauma center of excellence, which is actually based in Torrington. And I'm sorry I don't have the phone number right at hand, but there is an outstanding consultant who has taught Target and knows where it is available in the state, and her name is Eileen Russo. So again, that's the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services Center for Trauma Trauma Excellence. Center of Excellence for Trauma,
uh-huh.
And Eileen Russo is the key consultant who has a very good grasp on resources.
Okay. Well, Julian, it's been wonderful talking to you. I have something. I have your email address. If for you're interested, I have something that I've collaborated with educators on implementing this idea of the emotion roadmap we've talked about in schools, and I'll pass it along to you for your interest.
I would love to see that. Thank you, Chuck. I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you for allowing me to go on like the professor that I am.
Thank you so much for fascinating information, and I hope people do take advantage and call you. It sounds like you're doing some wonderful work, and you are personally making a very meaningful difference. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It takes one to know one.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye now.
Bye.